Thanks for the introduction, and I'm very happy to be here and tell you about some of the work that I've been doing in the past year. And just before we get started, let me just sort of give you the broad, very broad motivation of why I've started to be curious about this. Some of us in the field try to tell each other some tales to be more at ease with some of the observations we make in the universe. In particular, the cosmological constant is pretty small, and one of the leading proposals to explain that, or attempt to explain that, is the landscape proposal. The landscape proposal is particularly popular because it only relies on a very basic set of assumptions. The assumptions have been around for many, many decades, and those are essentially that you have many possible vacua, and you can have transitions between all of those vacua. So if you have a ton of vacua, even if they're distributed sort of uniformly in a large energy range, as long as you have enough of them, there will be some that have a very small cosmological constant. And so if you get to try out all of the different vacua, eventually you might end up living only in the ones where the cosmological constant is small enough to allow for galaxy formation. Now that's a very nice tale. And the first assumption of having large vacua, a large number of vacua, is one that can be checked in string theory. And in string theory, we have a large number of fields, and those fields appear to give rise to a huge number of vacua and possible values of the cosmological constant. So it seems like the first assumption is one that really kind of makes sense with string theory. Now, the second assumption is a little bit more delicate. We need to have transitions between all of these vacua. Now, why is this delicate? Well, in string theory, not only do we have all of those fields that give rise to many stable vacua, or hopefully stable vacua, but we also have other fields. String theory doesn't have any free parameters, which means that even the parameters that control the perturbative expansion have to get some potential. But typically, this potential is extremely small. But any time you have a potential barrier which is ridiculously small, those fields are at risk of just exploding during a vacuum transition. And I'll tell you more precisely how this works later on. But so even though string theory has all of these vacua, it seems sort of odd that in string theory you can have these transitions because you might not have any stable domain walls between any of your vacua. Now, if you don't have any domain walls between any of your vacua, that sort of poses the question of how do you get from one vacuum to the other vacuum. I will take this, this problem seriously and see what kind of constraints this puts on the cosmology that you can get from stable transition between different vacua. And it'll turn out that if you try to solve the cosmological constant problem in this way, not only do you solve the cosmological constant problem, but you only solve it if you have an extended period of inflation. Yes?
One of the consequences of inflation is that the constant perturbations of the neutron field create what's called internal inflation, which is multiverse.
It's very important, yes.
So if you have a multiverse?
Anytime you have a de Sitter vacuum which decays slowly, there would be a multiverse. So I will work at an extremely basic level, just taking into account two assumptions, which is there exists no domain walls between vacua, and there exists a large number of vacua. I will not address any of the details, and the details are important to be worked out, but I'm not going to address any of those. I agree it's very important. But let's make baby steps first. And just at the purely semi-classical level, we want to understand what happens if you have a vacuum in a scale of field theory which has a pretty high vacuum energy density that'll give rise to eternal inflation, and then whether that makes sense in UV theory is of course important, but I'll not address that. There are much more basic problems. So the first basic problem I've already told you is these vacuum transitions might not make sense in string theory. There's a second problem. Not only does it not really make sense in string theory, even at the semi-classical level, if you go back to the very early papers on vacuum transitions, you find that some of the decay channels of your vacuum have a decay rate which has a strictly infinite error bar. Now, if you have a quantity which determines your evolution and determines your physics with an infinite error bar, that's not too good to make any predictions. So I'll address in this talk both of these problems. The first will be understanding semi-classical vacuum decay in only semi-classical quantum gravity. And the second one will be addressing moduli stabilization in these vacuum transitions. So my talk is structured in two parts. The first part is in collaboration with Frederick Deneff, Kate Eckerle, and Ruben Montan. And if either of you is looking at postdoc applications, both Kate and Ruben will be available for hire if you're looking for someone. So remember their names, Kate and Ruben. And the second part about moduli stabilization is based on a work that I put out in August. And please do interrupt me if anything doesn't make sense. I'll not tell you any of the technical details. I find the very basic ideas confusing enough. So let's stick to those. Okay, so let's go on to, again, the basic motivation. If we look in the sky, it looks like the current universe came from some inflationary initial state. So the universe went through some extended period of expansion. And currently, the universe appears to be energy dominated. And so we have a small but positive vacuum energy density. The landscape idea is trying to at least address the second part, the small cosmological constant. And again, the idea is that you have a ton of different vacua. And so what kind of vacua can you have in a landscape? Well, I drew some very, very much toy model of a cartoon of a landscape. So we can have vacua with a large positive cosmological constant. Let's say those are stable. If you're sitting here, classically, we will remain in that vacuum. And if your decay rate is small enough, then you'll just keep sitting there, and this will drive eternal inflation. Then there can be other vacua, some where supersymmetry is broken, and your cosmological constant is ridiculously small. As long as you have a ton of vacua at all energies, there should be some where the cosmological constant is ridiculously small. In this landscape, there can be some saddle points or large parts of the potential which are sort of flat by chance. And if a field, a scalar field, rose along those, that would drive inflation. But because inflation is very sensitive to UV corrections, we don't expect those parts to be generic. If you just write down some potential, that will not generically drive inflation. So very rarely there will be these small vacuum energy density vacua. And very rarely, there will be some inflationary trajectories. Furthermore, there should be some points where the potential is either zero or negative, approximately supersymmetric points. Those could be decompactified solutions of string theory, where you're really living in your 10-dimensional string theory. This would be your maximum entropy state. Or in some field theory, this could be just a supersymmetric state of your field theory, with supersymmetry only broken by gravitational effects. Yes?
What do you mean by hope for the best?
Say again?
What do you mean by hope for the best?
Oh, so, the vacuum energy density, there is sort of a tale you can tell yourself, right? If you have all of these vacua, and you start, let's say, up here, you can end up in a vacuum with a small energy density if you have these transitions. And you say you only want to live in a galaxy. Now, for the initial state, if you want an initial state that drives inflation, well, you need an initial state which has a pretty low entropy, which sort of seems odd. And the landscape idea doesn't really, there's no strong selection bias towards inflationary trajectories. There might be some selection bias, but it's not entirely clear. It's not such a strong case as the requirement of having galaxies. So for the cosmological constant, it's a very strong selection bias. For inflationary trajectories, we might just have to hope for the best.
The problem is that it's very hard to start.
That's right.
It's improbable.
Very improbable. So
it's very improbable. Why are we doing it?
That's right. That's why I'm giving the talk right now. So it's a problem. Currently, we sort of have to hope for the best, but let's think a little more carefully. So how do we get to our viable vacuum? Well, we can be really lucky that we start off in some internally inflating initial condition where the leading tunneling trajectory leaves you precisely at an initial state which drives slow wall inflation, at the end of which, when slow wall inflation stops, you might have a reheating and generate all of the galaxies that then we can observe. Now, as you mentioned, that is slightly ridiculous because those inflationary trajectories and these inflationary initial states have to be really fine-tuned. You wouldn't expect those. So at least for inflation, why wouldn't you start off in a generic vacuum, which doesn't have an inflationary trajectory connecting you to the metastable state? Now, this is not the only problem. The other problem is that you have to start off at a high vacuum energy density. And then there comes the question, who put you there? So of course you can say, well, let's just ignore that. But that's not really satisfactory. Notice also that this decay rate here has a squiggly line. Anytime that a squiggly line appears, you should really wonder, what does this really mean? Did you really compute a decay rate? Anytime you compute a rate, you better know exactly what your time coordinate is. However, in quantum gravity, you have full diffeomorphism invariants, which means that nothing explicitly depends on your variable t, which traditionally in quantum field theory would be your time. So at least nowhere in the literature, it has explicitly been computed what the decay rate is. Typically, what you compute is a transmission coefficient. And then you say, well, the exponential scaling won't be too far off. And that gives you this answer that the decay rate is e to the minus the Euclidean action of the trajectory creating a bubble of your new state. OK, that sort of works as long as you go from high energies to lower energies, and you have those kinds of transitions. But we actually have another vacuum here. This vacuum has a much higher entropy. It has a low energy. And it's really the most, like statistically, the most likely state that you should start off with. And in fact, if you think about just Einstein's equation, there does exist a trajectory where you start off in your asymptotically flat, almost supersymmetric state, and then you go anywhere in the landscape. In particular, you can go exactly to the point where slow wall inflation started. And then you can roll down there. Now, that seems, at first sight, even more ridiculous than anything we've been talking about, right? You sort of just do exactly what you want, right? So you start off in this vacuum, and then you go wherever you want, and you say, life is good. So there are a couple of problems with this. The first one is, if you compute the Euclidean action for this process, the Euclidean action is negative. So if you try to use your usual squiggly line argument for computing a transmission coefficient, and saying, well, that should sort of be the decay rate, you do the same thing. You find a strictly infinite decay rate for these processes. Now, that's not too good. So, well, what can you do? You can remember you have a squiggly line. You don't really know what the sign in front here is. So let's just switch the sign. And people have done that. And if you switch the sign, then you have a small decay rate. And that's sort of what you might expect in an almost classical theory, right? As the Euclidean action becomes really large, you sort of expect that quantum fluctuations don't do too much. However, quantum gravity might be confusing you a little bit. So maybe there isn't something that's bad with an infinite decay rate because we don't really understand quantum gravity. So these processes kind of make sense that people don't consider them. Notice, however, that if you take the positive sign here, low entropy initial states are favored, and they're exponentially favored compared to high entropy initial states. So at least it should be a good motivation to really try to understand these kinds of trajectories better and really understand what is the rate, I mean a rate where you know what your time coordinate is, and you know what observer sees nucleation rates. And compute this rate and resolve the sign ambiguity. And if those trajectories really exist, then they might actually be the prime candidate for giving rise to inflationary initial states.
Put in the plus side, raises the eyebrows of
quantum theory. Yeah. Well, we're doing quantum gravity, so. So we'll see exactly what the sign is, and it turns out you need to be a little bit careful and take the different morphism invariants of the theory seriously. Okay, now that's the first problem. We don't really know at the semi-classical level how vacuum decay works, and that's what I'll resolve in the first part of the talk. And the second part of the talk is what I told you earlier, which is moduli stabilization is hard. In particular, some of the fields that control quantum corrections, they're really hard to stabilize in string theory. So before we had this nice landscape of different vacua, and we have large bumps between these different vacua, but because we want to, let's say, stabilize the overall volume of your compactification, we also have another direction in the landscape, which has a much smaller bump. This bump is much smaller because the only effects that stabilize this vacuum, at least in a weakly coupled theory, are slight cancellations between different quantum effects. So this means the landscape potential, let's say, is order one. It's a tree-level effect. But this stabilizing potential in the perturbative control direction is only a small cancellation between different quantum effects. So even if you start and produce a domain wall between different vacua, this domain wall might actually be unstable, because on the inside of your bubble, you might have a stable vacuum. On the outside of your bubble, you have a stable vacuum. But at the domain wall, you have to go over this large bump of the stabilizing potential in your landscape. This contributes a large amount of energy density, which will generically destabilize your moduli. So that's something that Matt and many others have pointed out. It's really an obstacle to populating the landscape. And so what will happen is if you try to nucleate your bubble, let's start to make a bubble with some de Sitter phase on the inside, a different de Sitter phase on the outside. You would hope that this bubble sort of expands. But because the domain wall is unstable, your moduli fly away, and your domain wall starts to decay. And so really what you end up with is this true vacuum bubble of your hostile phase where the moduli all fly away that will be expanding both to the outside and to the inside. And so your new de Sitter phase is actually going to be terminated because the vacuum energy density in this decompactification phase where your moduli fly away can be zero, and that energy density is smaller than the energy density in your de Sitter bubble. So you really didn't have a vacuum transition. So that motivates the second assumption, which is, let's say we don't have any stable domain walls between different de Sitter phases. Do you have a question? Okay.
Yeah. So I think the following evolution after bubble creation should be kind of an analytic continuation of the. So how could the domain wall quantize on that
paper? It is. Well, I'm not. Right, so the domain wall would be an analytic continuation of the time coordinate if you have a stable domain wall. But really, the configuration that we started out with here is just some field profile. You can make essentially any field profile in the de Sitter space you want, but that might not be a solution to your equations of motion. Right, so if we start off with this field profile that goes from one vacuum in the landscape to the other vacuum in the landscape, that actually is not a solution to the equation of motion, because up here, your domain wall is really on a slope. So the field up here will start to roll down in that direction. So in the end, you only end up with domain walls between vacuum one and exploded moduli and vacuum two and exploded moduli. There are no domain walls between the two vacua. So those are really, there just don't exist any stable domain walls. And so that's generic, so let's try to take it seriously. Okay, so very briefly again, the two problems we'll solve today is we'll carefully compute a transition rate in a gravitational theory, taking into account only semi-classical effects. And what I'll show you is that the decay rate, which now I really mean a decay rate, is approximately given by the exponential of the negative absolute value of the Euclidean action. And we'll see how the absolute value comes about. It comes about very non-trivially. It's not an assumption. It is really a computation that I'll show you. And it could have gone the other way. And secondly, I'll assume that there exists no stable domain walls between cosmological vacua. Are there still any potential ways that you can populate the landscape? And the answer is yes, but only if every vacuum that you populate goes through an extended period of inflation. And you need exactly enough inflation to generate super horizon correlations. So anyone who is living in a landscape that is populated in this way will look in the sky and be really confused why the temperature on both sides of the sky is equal. All right, so the very brief plan is, again, the first paper is work that is to appear soon about vacuum decay with people at Columbia. And the second part is about the impact of moduli stabilization. So again, I'm not going to mention any technical details, but let's just briefly review the kind of system that we have in mind if we want to study vacuum decay. So very roughly, typically, if you think about vacuum decay, you have in mind some kind of scalar field theory. So you have some scalar field phi, which has two different vacua at different values of the potential energy. And in a certain limit, the domain wall between two of these vacua can be rather thin. And that's an assumption that we'll make, which is the domain wall separating these two phases is thin enough that we don't actually have to include any of the physics of this scalar. So in effect, all we have is this kind of picture, where we look at a bubble from the outside. So we have, on the inside, a constant vacuum energy density. Then we have a domain wall. Under domain wall, the tension is equal to the energy density. And then on the outside, we have a different vacuum energy density. In addition to the vacuum energy density, of course, the mass on the inside of the bubble and the mass on the outside of the bubble can be non-zero. That means that the metric on the inside and outside takes this form. It's just a Schwarzschild de Sitter metric if we constrain to positive vacuum energy densities. So after integrating out the scalar field, the only parameters that we have left is the domain wall tension, the mass of the bubble, and the Hubble scale on the inside and the outside. So that's a much simpler system to study. The action for the system is well known. It's just the Einstein-Hilbert action, plus some meta-Lagrangian, where we say, well, the meta-Lagrangian could in principle be the scalar field, but because we integrate it out, it's a meta-Lagrangian that just gives rise to this kind of stress energy tensor. That is, we have some energy density located at the domain wall, and we have some vacuum energy density on the inside and the outside. So that's a much simpler theory. And of course, we have boundary terms in order to ensure that Hamilton's equation is satisfied. So the degrees of freedom that we have are the metric degrees of freedom. If you write down the most general spherically symmetric metric, we have four free parameters, or free functions, really. Those are the lapse and the shift, and these functions L and R. So those are four functions. And in addition to the four functions, we have one discrete parameter, which is the position of the domain wall. So we have 5 degrees of freedom. Out of those 5 degrees of freedom, if you look at this metric, you see that a coordinate redefinition can always absorb both the lapse and the shift. So those will not appear as dynamical fields in the action, but rather just Lagrange multipliers that enforce Einstein's equations. So our dynamical fields are really just this L and R, and the position of the domain wall. Did you have a question? So that was probably somewhat confusing. So let's just take a step back and forget about the domain wall for now, and let's just draw some picture. So we pick a very specific gauge. So picking a gauge corresponds to picking the lapse and the shift to be some simple functions. So I pick them 1 and 0 just for simplicity. And let's just say we have a constant vacuum energy density. And there's no domain wall, so there's no inside or outside. Solving the equations of motion of the system gives rise to a very simple solution, which is just the Sitter space, as you would have expected for a positive vacuum energy density. We can parameterize the Sitter space in closed slicing. As such, it's just an hyperboloid. And if we take a constant time slice of the Sitter space is just a sphere, which you can see here. So here we take the hyperboloid, take a time slice at t equals 0, and look at that from the top, which just is a circle. But because, so what this is here is r, this r coordinate. But because the r coordinate really is a circle, and it appears in front of the prefactor of a two-sphere, the geometry of this whole thing is a three-sphere, which, if you've ever thought about the Sitter space, is exactly what you expect. So this is a spatial geometry, which is not typically how we think about the Sitter space, or at least some of us don't think about it that way. So I've also drawn a conformal diagram. This is because this is a circle. If you're sitting on this side of the circle, you will never be able to communicate with anyone on the other side of the circle. This just means that in the Sitter space, there are two patches that cannot communicate with each other. In a conformal diagram, this would correspond to sitting on this side of the conformal diagram versus sitting to the opposite side of the conformal diagram. And so it kind of makes sense that the radius of the circle is just the De Sitter horizon. So yeah, that will be an important quantity, because we will now start to quantize these spatial geometries. Those So one De Sitter space is the whole hyperboloid. So right now, I have one De Sitter space. In a minute, once we add a domain wall, then we have two De Sitter phases. But in total, we don't have any De Sitter space anymore. So let's add a bubble. If we have a domain wall, what we essentially do is we take a part of a different De Sitter space with a different cosmological constant, and glue that to our initial De Sitter space. So let's say we take a bubble which has an interior with a smaller cosmological constant, which means that the horizon is larger, so the radius of curvature of our circle is going to be larger. So that's the lower part here. And then we glue that together with the rest of the De Sitter space. So what this is telling you, this is the spatial configuration of a bubble that's taking up less than half of the original De Sitter space. So is there any question about these diagrams? Those will be important. OK. Now, we can also solve for the equations of motion, or the constraint equations, that determine how does the radius at which the domain wall is sitting evolve with time. And a particularly useful parameterization is to solve just for the mass parameter on the inside and the mass parameter on the outside, which gives you this long equation here. And even though this equation has many terms, you can sort of, in a simple way, understand it, because everything is sort of a contribution to the energy density, the energy of your bubble. It's the mass parameter of the bubble. So the first term here, you can simply recognize as the contribution to the mass coming from the vacuum energy. because it's different on the inside and the outside, you get some contribution. The next term here comes from the relativistic energy of the domain wall. So if it's moving fast, you get a larger contribution to the energy. And here you can see essentially the area of the domain wall times the tension. And then here you have some term coming from the gravitational self-interaction of the domain wall. Now, don't get too fixated on the details. The details don't really matter. But we can solve this equation for the velocity, which is something like a potential. And this potential sort of tells us what kind of trajectories are possible in the system. So what I'm plotting here is the size of the domain wall. And I'm showing you the velocity of the domain wall. So you can have a trajectory going from zero radius to some finite radius and recollapsing again. And you can have a trajectory that starts at some finite radius and grows indefinitely. So they're both bound states in this theory, and they're unbound states. And the quantum mechanical tunneling corresponds to having a bound state, which is expanding, hitting the domain wall, and instead of being reflected, it's transmitted to an unbound state and starts to expand. And so even though we don't have any scale of field theory anymore, we still have the full tunneling dynamics in the system. Now, of course, this is a gravitational theory. And tunneling isn't quite as simple as it is in quantum field theory. Particularly, we don't have a time coordinate. So before we do anything with the gravitational theory, let's just start and practice using techniques in quantum mechanics to compute the semi-classical tunneling rate in a theory that has a time reparametrization invariance. So this is just a very brief lecture on semi-classical quantum mechanics. And we'll do it in a slightly different way from the way you might have seen it in your quantum mechanics class. So this is the only technical point that I'm trying to make, but I think it's sort of nice. Let's start off with a Lagrangian of this form. So at first sight, this doesn't really look very familiar. But really what we're doing here is, for now, ignore this term here. Let's say E is some constant. And so this term here, E times theta dot, is dynamically irrelevant. It's just a boundary term. So for now, ignore it. Then we have this Lagrange multiplier, lambda, here. There's no kinetic term for this Lagrange multiplier. So what the equations of motion for lambda do is they just enforce that this term here vanishes identically. So once we impose the equations of motion for lambda, this is really just saying the same thing as saying you have some field Q that has a conjugate momentum P, and I tell you that the conjugate momentum is this function. It's some function f of Q and E. So we've just rewritten classically the system that you would have had in any kind of quantum mechanics system. So in quantum mechanics, where you have some potential and some energy, your momentum would be given by this expression. And that's really just saying that you have some particle with some momentum. But I've rewritten it in this weird way. Now, why have I done this? It's because if you look at the Hamiltonian of this full theory, the Hamiltonian is just this last part. But the equations of motion of lambda enforce that the Hamiltonian equals zero. Now, if you have a quantum mechanical system with the Hamiltonian equals to zero, that means it's an energy eigenstate at zero energy. There is no evolution with T. But that's exactly the same that you would have had in a gravitational theory. There's no evolution with T. You can reparameterize your time coordinate, and nothing changes. Of course, that doesn't mean that you don't have a non-trivial wave equation. Because if you quantize this part of the theory, you can still have a non-trivial wave equation, except for you don't yet know what the time variable is.
So we have to wait for
it. Almost, yeah. Except for here, we don't work with functionals. we only work with discrete variables. And so I understand, but yeah, it's the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Okay, now that we've added this extra term, E times theta dot, is really just a boundary term if E is constant, right? It doesn't change your dynamics at all. However, if you look at the equations of motion for E, the equations of motion are just that theta dot is dependent on your Lagrange multiplier. So if you set your Lagrange multiplier to 1, theta dot is just proportional, or theta is just proportional to time. So what theta is, it's a clock. So there you can see how you've repackaged the time variable in a way such that the whole theory is invariant under T reparametrizations, but not invariant under clock reparametrizations. Right? So we have this explicit field, theta, which is a clock. At the semi-classical level, we might only be interested in this theory around very small energies. So we can expand this function f around very small energies and rewrite only at the classical level the theory as such. So now we have a different Lagrange multiplier, and the constraint is just that E equals to this function h. That's the equation of motion for our new Lagrange multiplier. So on shell, if we enforce the equation of motion, this constraint just enforces that the energy is equal to this function h, with h being this particular combination. Enforcing the equations of motion for both lambda and theta, you find that your Lagrangian really looks like your standard Lagrangian in mechanics, with h being this particular function. But we started with a time reparametrization invariant theory. Note also that because the constraint equation is E equals h, but E, we knew, was the momentum corresponding to some field in our theory, we know how to quantize E. Right? Canonical quantization just tells us that any field, any momentum corresponding to any field, is replaced to minus I times the derivative with respect to that field. So if we take this equation, E equals h, and replace E, the momentum corresponding to theta, with minus I d d theta, that just ends us up with the Schrödinger equation. And here it was crucial that we picked this particular gauge, which makes this look like a Schrödinger equation. Of course, we could have chosen any other time coordinate. It would have given us the Schrödinger equation using in a different time. Yeah? Here?
Yes.
The approximation is that E is very small. So I've expanded this function f around small e. And that will be the relevant thing to do later on when we want to have an almost massless bubble. All right, so if you start off with any theory and you know the momentum conjugate to some field, then you know what effective Hamiltonian to use in quantizing that system. And here it wasn't a problem at all that this was a time reparametrization invariant theory. Now, if you want to compute a decay rate, the most straightforward thing to do is to compute poles in the propagator. So I'm writing here the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator. And in order to make this integral convergent, we have to give a small imaginary part to the energy such that this integral is really convergent. This I epsilon prescription will be very crucial in a minute. Using the path integral formulation for the propagator, which is not the Fourier transform of the propagator, we can write the whole propagator as such. But because we are only interested in semi-classical trajectories, these paths over P and Q, almost all of them don't contribute. The only ones that contribute are the paths that satisfy the equations of motion. And the equation of motion were H equals E. And we have the constraint paths that start at some initial Q and end at a final Q. Yes?
Since you're dealing with gravity, and you know there are any branch cuts?
We'll see what P is, and we will also see that this I epsilon prescription exactly tells you how to deal with the branch cuts. But notice also that since in quantum mechanics, you typically go from one turning point to the other turning point, and then you have to integrate around a branch cut, which gives you a phase in this path integral. We're not doing that because we only work at the semi-classical level, which means that you're never allowed to leave any classical trajectories. So we never cross any branch cuts. And we can do that because the contribution to the path integral would only be something at a lower order in h bar. So if we reinstate the h bar here, this would be 1 over h bar plus h bar to the zeroth corrections. And integrating of the branch cuts would give us a quantum correction, but that is not something that's part of our theory. Say again? No Wick rotation ever, no. No Wick rotation. That is crucial because, as you'll see in a second, once you do a Wick rotation, you don't know which direction to rotate in. And at least it's a little bit more confusing to me. Let's not do that. I never want to Wick rotate. But the I epsilon prescription tells you what contour to integrate over. And so let's do this for a very simple potential and recover the old answer that you would have guessed. So what we have here is a potential over some field Q, which has some metastable state here. And this metastable state is confined by some potential barrier. And then you have just the potential is falling off. If we want to compute the poles of the propagator corresponding to some confined state, what we want to compute is the sum over the path integral for all possible trajectories that start at some initial q and end at an initial q. So let's say our initial q is somewhere in this confined region. So we want to sum over all of the paths that go like once in the classical region, or that go twice through the classical regions, go n times bouncing back and forth between in the classical region. If you only compute those contributions and you include the contributions in one higher order in h bar, what you get is just simply the zero point energy of that system. But the zero point energy is something in a higher order in h bar, so we don't want to compute that. But those are not the only contributions to the potential or to the path integral. You also have contributions where you start in the confined region, go to the classical turning point, go further once through the confined region, and then return to your initial state. So if you sum over all the possible configurations, you have, well, first, all of the contributions coming from bouncing around in the classically allowed region. And you can bounce n times back and forth. And then you have a contribution coming from bouncing around in the classically prohibited region. Note that you never only solve the equations of motion in either the classically allowed or the classically forbidden region. You always know how to go from one to the other because your velocity will never vanish. And it doesn't vanish because of the I epsilon prescription. Right? So typically, at the classical turning point, your momentum vanishes. And then as you go from the classically allowed region to the classically forbidden region, your momentum either becomes positive imaginary or negative imaginary. But depending on which sign you choose in this branch cut, that will give a different sign in this exponent. But because we had this I epsilon prescription, and we know epsilon is positive, even at the turning point, the momentum never vanishes. And the I epsilon prescription tells you exactly what the sign is here. The sign is such that this corresponds to a mode that's going to the right. In the WKB approximation, this would correspond to exactly just the matching conditions at the wall, which determine what the sign is of the wave function. Yes?
So the actual truth is not from the physical human shit. Physical human shit.
That's right. And we need to know which one we want to be on. Right? So that's where the I-epsilon prescription is very important. So if we do all of this, the sum, we end up with this denominator. And we can solve for the energy that's corresponding to a pole when this denominator becomes zero. And the energy is given by this. Here we've expanded like this quantity A. A corresponds to the classical action of one outgoing pass through the loud region, and B corresponds to the action of one outgoing pass through the classically prohibited region. And your energy, E, at the resonance, has a very small, well, has an imaginary part, which is determined by E to the IB. So if we plug in what B was in normal quantum mechanical theory, this would just be E to the plus or minus the integral over the square root of the potential. And the denominator here is simply the time it takes to make one pass through that classically allowed region. So in some sense, you could imagine this as the transition probability times the number of bounces you do per unit time. But notice that because we know what the I-epsilon prescription is, in principle, we will know what this exactly is. There's no sign ambiguity here.
Why does B have buttons?
Well, B is the action corresponding to a given trajectory. And the action is essentially the integral over your momentum. In a classically forbidden region, your momentum would become imaginary. And very roughly, the exponential of a decay rate, which really is a decay rate, is the integral of your momentum using the right I-epsilon prescription of an outgoing mode in the classically forbidden region. The sign is fixed because we're only looking at an outgoing mode, which means that in the classically allowed region, we need to have that the velocity of this thing is positive. And that is fixing uniquely the sign of this exponent. Okay, now that we have done everything in quantum mechanics, let's turn to the equivalent problem in terms of gravity. And I'm skipping about 20 pages of derivation here, but essentially, the action looks pretty much similar to the system that I've just shown you. We have some quantity r, which corresponds to the position of the domain wall. We have a momentum that's conjugate to it. And we know what that momentum is. The momentum is given by this sort of lengthy function, has some log in it, and these functions r prime, I don't even tell you what they are. There are some long functions, only depending on the parameters in our theory that I've shown you initially. And then we have this term, where A is essentially the total area of your horizons in the system. So there are explicit expressions for all of this, but all that I want to tell you is that we know what this function f of r and this quantity m plus is. So in addition, in the gravitational system, we have a boundary term, which is m plus times t dot. But because we're working in gravitational theory, we know exactly what m plus and t dot is. M plus is precisely the Schwarzschild to Sitter mass parameter on the outside of the bubble. And t is precisely the corresponding conjugate variable, which is the Schwarzschild to Sitter static patch time coordinate. So this is already very much reduced, but it's really a function of your original variables, L and R, and all of your gauge fixings. But if you do everything correctly, you notice that you have exactly this part. And that's sort of nice, because that might be what you expected. The energy corresponds to your Schwarzschild to Sitter mass parameter. And the corresponding time, the variable conjugate to that mass parameter, is just the static patch time coordinate. So that really looks like the time translations, or T translations, are generated by the mass parameter. OK, but I've just shown you how to deal with such a system. And now we can compute the outgoing action through the classically forbidden region. And if you do that, you find that the decay rate is given by, again, e to the ib, with b given by this lengthy expression here. Now, it's sort of a lengthy expression. However, notice that, again, we have this plus minus sign ambiguity, which will be fixed by ensuring that in the classically loud region, the domain wall is moving outwards. And if you compute the sign of r dot in this theory, just by imposing the equations of motion, you find that the sign is exactly negative the sign of this expression in the exponent. But that means that your decay rate is e to the minus the absolute value of this lengthy expression. Note that this lengthy expression is sort of unwieldy, but really what it is just, if you've ever read Coleman DeLucia paper, they have this long expression for the decay rate. It's that with a slight generalization coming from the fact that you can have baby universes. So what this equation really tells you is the generalized vacuum transition rate that includes both Coleman DeLucia decay and baby universe nucleation and universes from nothing in the limit that the domain wall tension goes to zero. So this is the most general expression. But also, we know what the nucleation rate for all of these processes is. In particular, we see that the nucleation rate of a baby universe is not infinite. It's a finite thing. It's a pretty small thing in the limit that this action becomes large. All right, and here you can see the possible trajectories. Here we start off with some initial state. It's just a sitter. We have a true vacuum bubble nucleation. You just recover the Coleman-DeLucia tunneling rate. And if you want to nucleate a false vacuum bubble, so you want to tunnel to a higher state in your theory, the leading decay channel is to nucleate a baby universe. And the decay rate is given by essentially e to the minus the entropy of your new de Sitter space. OK, so we've learned that we know the sign in the transition rate. And it was very important that we knew what the time coordinate is and in which direction it goes. There's no ambiguity in which direction you should analytically continue. But that was just a confusion that came about because you threw out the thing that generates time translations. So if you look at the whole system, including finite mass parameters, and you know what generates time translations, there's no ambiguity in the exponent of something that you can honestly call a decay rate, with the time being the time of an observer who's sitting statically in the static patch. OK, now in the last, are there any questions about this?
One quick question.
Yes?
What do you do about the one that sits on top, where there's no time evolution?
Sits on top. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we can talk after. Okay, now that we understand vacuum decay, or at least very roughly, and the last 10 minutes, let me tell you how we can apply that to this second problem. So first, we now know that in a classical theory, semi-classical theory, there exists all of these vacuum transitions, including the crazy one that goes from this really low entropy state to a very high entropy state. And so those should sort of exist. But in string theory, there are arguments that tell you that there are no domain walls between the sitter vacua. So let's briefly discuss that. Very roughly, the idea is that if you have some modulus which controls quantum corrections to your theory, as you take that parameter to infinity, you turn off all of the quantum corrections, which means that that field doesn't experience a potential anymore, because that field itself only got a potential from quantum corrections. Now, any potential can approach zero either from above or from below. So in order to get a metastable state, you need to have some delicate cancellation between different quantum corrections. But that means that this potential barrier is much smaller than the typical scale in your landscape. In particular, if you now try to couple this field chi, which is your modulus, to some field in the landscape phi, at least, at the very least, you'll have some Planck-suppressed couplings of this type. So let's try to make a bubble where on the inside we have one field value. On the outside, we have another field value of our landscape. So this is our domain wall going between two vacua. The potential for our modulus has a stable minimum on the inside of the bubble. It has a stable minimum on the outside. But because of this Planck-suppressed coupling, at the domain wall, you have this large contribution to the energy, and that destabilizes your moduli. So what this tells you is that there exist no domain walls, and that's a problem if you want to populate the landscape, as Matt has pointed out. Okay, now let's return to this, simple question. We have two vacua, A and B, which are our landscape, and let's say we start off in some initial state, A, and we want to go to the final viable vacuum, B, but there do not exist any domain walls between A and B. There only exist domain walls between your initial state, A, and your hostile decompactification phase, and between the decompactification phase and your vacuum, B. What are the kind of transitions that you can have to go from A to B? Well, the only ones that are possible are transitions where you have a bubble between vacuum C inside of vacuum A, and then inside that vacuum C, you have another bubble of your new vacuum B. So this configuration is a double bubble, where on the inside you have one bubble going from B to C, and then going from C to A. Now, unfortunately, you know that the vacuum energy density in C is smaller than the vacuum energy density in either of your de Sitter vacua. That means the only kind of configurations that are allowed are of this type. So there exists a wormhole in this region C, which essentially is just the same as saying that those are the kind of transitions that are, well, they include the kind of transitions that go from low vacuum energy density to high vacuum energy density, which are those, the ones that I showed you initially, which in the meantime we've concluded maybe aren't so crazy at all. The bubble nucleation process looks like so. We start with our initial phase A, and then you nucleate a really small bubble inside a bubble, and then this bubble kind of grows, and what you end up with is this kind of double bubble. Now, using this result that we've derived before, that the nucleation rate is e to the minus the absolute value of this integral, we find that the nucleation rate is given by this thing. And even though this looks sort of complicated, you can still recognize some of the basic features, which is this kappa here is essentially a domain wall tension. It contributes with some, let's say, positive sign to this expression. And then let's set this term to zero here. You have a different term that contributes with an opposite sign. And that's exactly what you had before, where we had a positive Euclidean action. If you have a Coleman-Deluce decay, that is, the domain wall tension is dominating the action. And the contribution to the action coming from the de Sitter phase contributes with the opposite sign. So that would naively make your Euclidean action negative, but it really just enters with an opposite sign. So you have two terms that are potentially canceling each other. So even if you thought that you have some Coleman-Deluce decay, which is really suppressed, if there exists another vacuum at some other scale with some other domain wall tensions, it might be that these terms actually cancel in a way that is the leading decay channel. So a priori, you don't necessarily know what is your leading decay channel because you have these non-trivial cancellations in the nucleation rate of the double bubble. Notice also that high Hubble scales are favored by these kinds of transitions. If high Hubble scales are favored, this means that you're more likely to go to a low entropy state. So that might be a little bit confusing, and you can compute the rate to, let's say, nucleate a very small bubble at almost a Planck scale. And what you find is that the nucleation rate of such an object is suppressed by longer than the age of the universe. So even at almost a Planck scale, you don't have those things bubbling up. But if you have, let's say, an eternal time to wait for these things to happen, those might actually be the leading decay channels, especially if you start off in a very low very large entropy, low energy initial state. Okay, now I've only told you about going from one de Sitter space to another de Sitter space. In our universe, we're not really living at gut scale inflation, but we're living at a much lower scale. So what has happened in the past, potentially, is that we had some very high energy density initial state with some approximately constant Hubble scale, which then evolved and ended inflation to some much lower state. But in this kind of picture, what we had before was we essentially have a domain wall here that's sitting on the other side of our Hubble horizon. So if you have this kind of domain wall, and suddenly you lower your Hubble scale, it is possible that the domain wall, which was originally outside of your Hubble horizon and would never have interfered with you, suddenly might enter your Hubble horizon. Now, if there's a domain wall inside of your Hubble horizon and outside of the domain wall, the vacuum energy density is lower than inside, that domain wall might come right at you. And so what you have to ensure if you want to be safe for eternity is that you have enough inflation such that this domain wall remains outside of your late-time horizon. Otherwise, that domain wall might come and eat you. And so if you're familiar with conformal diagrams, this is sort of how this looks. So what I'm plotting here is the co-moving Hubble sphere during the evolution of our universe. So during inflation, when the Hubble scale is approximately constant, that co-moving Hubble sphere is shrinking. Then you have reheating. And let's say we have radiation domination, which means that our Hubble sphere is growing. And at some late time, we have energy domination again, which means that our Hubble sphere is shrinking again. Now, if our universe came from one of those nucleation events, at the beginning, we have not only inflation, but we also have this disconnected domain wall moving away from us at the speed of light. But at the time of reheating, this domain wall can change directions and start coming at us because we've changed the energy density. And so if this is inside of a horizon, it might come and eat us up. Now, the requirement that this domain wall doesn't ever reach us is that it always stays outside of our late-time Hubble sphere. But if you look at these lines, if we plot here a light ray that goes back from CMB, from when the CMB was created, this is almost exactly the same requirement. So essentially, what this tells us is that in order to make sure that this domain wall stays outside of our late-time horizon forever, we have to ensure that all past light cones from the time of recombination have some overlapping past, right? So this is the overlapping past here. But that is precisely the same requirement as demanding that you have solved the horizon problem, and coincidentally, that also solves the curvature problem. So I think I'm 5 minutes over, so let me just very briefly conclude. Time is important if you want to study vacuum decay. You cannot just say, oh, I don't care about time, Euclideanize my time and hope for the best. That'll leave you with a sign ambiguity, which is resolved if you pay attention to what the time is. Decay rates are always suppressed. You don't have infinities. And next, moduli stabilization is important. if you take into account moduli stabilization and really take that requirement seriously, all of the vacua that are populated might have experienced an extended period of inflation, enough inflation to solve the horizon problem. So this is really a connection between the landscape solution to the CC problem and solving the initial state problem. Thank you. I think that's right. So in quantum mechanics, you can never actually take the mass parameter to zero because you need to quantize all of the fields in your theory. If you quantize both the energy, or if you quantize both your clock and your field, then you cannot take the mass parameter exactly to zero. It is always something non-zero. And that should resolve that issue. Notice that in the end, I did take the limit of m goes to zero, but I did have this the equations of motion that tell me in which direction does time go.
All the question is, so do your rates include the penalty of creating the bound state in the first place?
No.
I believe it's generally agreed. Quantum fluctuations, cost of inflation.
Well, that would be another eternally inflating state.
Yeah.
However, in order to make sure that the quantum fluctuations dominate, you need to have control over an infinite tower of Planck suppressed operators in your theory. And I don't know of a theory that gives rise to that. So I'm not addressing that issue.
Yeah.
I have nothing to say about this.
Why not?
Well, I've been working at the leading semi-classical level. I have a very hard time to understand quantum gravity. So I don't know. So notice though that I never relied on having any vacua at some high energy density. There might just not be any of those eternally inflating vacua. You might be sitting only at the decompactified, almost supersymmetric state, no internal inflation at all, but still you can jump to some inflationary trajectory, which isn't stable, and then fall off in some low-scale, Susie-broken, viable vacuum. So while this makes sense, if you include eternal inflation, at least false vacuum eternal inflation, it wasn't a requirement.
That's a very basic question. Perhaps I missed it in your explain, but why can't a double bubble to a vacuum with
a bubble? Oh, you can. Yeah. Yeah, there are all sorts of, you need to consider all possible decay channels. It's just that because anything that's hidden behind a horizon, instead of being suppressed at high energies, you actually get an enhancement of the tunneling rate at high energies. So these kinds of trajectories favor very high Hubble scales. Essentially, you've like, because you're essentially behind the horizon of a wormhole, your time coordinate goes the other way, which means that instead of having the second law, you have like the opposite of the second law. And so you favor low entropy states. Now, this might sound too good to be true, but in fact, in semi-classical gravity, it is a fine solution. And of course, it'd be very interesting to understand if in a UV complete theory, that is also a fine solution.
Wormhole solution, GR, you can't get through because the wormhole pinches in. really excited about it.
So the local energy conditions are violated during the tunneling process. I've solved explicitly for the tunneling trajectory. So if you're sitting within a Hubble radius of the place where the bubble nucleates, you should just be sucked right through. And I think it's really because the local energy conditions are violated during the tunneling, which is fine for quantum fields. Say again? Or quantum fields. You don't get through these wormholes after the tunneling or before the tunneling. Only during the tunneling, while your Euclidean momenta become imaginary, while your momenta become imaginary, only during this time the energy conditions are violated, and that's how you can be sucked through one of those wormholes. But maybe you all, like, I mean, you got to be pretty small to be sort of sucked through a gut scale wormhole.
So you can't get a spacecraft.
No, I'm sorry.
In purpose.
Yeah.
This is too bad.
Yeah, it's too bad.